Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Time to Talk. My name's Alex Holmes, and I'm your host. Just a quick note. For the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be away, so I'm not going to really have a chance to do the introspective conversations. I'm taking a break. So the next few episodes are going to be conversations, going to be the full conversations that I've had with friends. And I'll be back in November with some solo episodes. And in these solo episodes, we're going to be looking a bit more in depth at men's mental health, as it's November and that's Movember. And we'll be taking that up until the beginning of December, where I'll be taking the seasonal break. And then after December, we'll be back in January. So I'm going to be away for 2 weeks, but in those 2 weeks, there are going to be two conversations that are going to be shared on this channel. I just want to say thank you for kind of joining me with this new resurgence of the podcast. I really appreciate you all, and I'm hoping that you have blessed end of months. The clocks in the UK, they go back. We enter into the period of darkness, but not so much in a solemn way. I think that there is something really special about this period of time, this period of history, this period of the year. The rolling into winter from autumn, and you know, the end of the year, Halloween, and what that looks like going into various celebrations. I know that people who listen celebrate Thanksgiving, then we head to Christmas, and that is a very special time for me since it's my birthday month and whatnot. So I just want to say thank you for joining me this far, and I hope that these conversations take you into the next few weeks. This conversation is with a friend of mine called Mark McCartney, and he wrote a newsletter called What is a Good Life? And we have a discussion about what that is, about what his experience with that is, whether we managed to answer that question, and what we can experience in our day-to-day to kind of put us on the path to a good life. Looking forward to hearing you listen to Mark and sharing what you think, your thoughts, your experiences. Again, as I said, I'm playing around with structure and things that I want to share and how I want to share it on this show. So when I come back, I'm going to have very specific content for you, as I mentioned. And I'm looking forward to sharing that part with you. But for now, let's have a listen to the conversation with Mark McCartney. And I look forward to catching up with you in a few weeks. Talk soon. Pleasure to have you here. I'm a huge fan of your newsletter, and we're going to get into that in a moment. But before we do, tell the people about who you are. What are your beginnings? How did you get here?
So as you can probably tell by the accent, I'm from Ireland, but I haven't lived in Ireland for 10 years. I spent the first 25 years of my life in Ireland, then moved to Vancouver for about 4 years or so. Spent some time in London, met my wife, my German wife, in northern India, spent some time in Vancouver again, back to Peru, and now in Berlin. And professionally in that time, I had a career in capital markets, so financial roles for about 15 years. But then I'd say maybe 6 to 7 years ago, my life kind of forked from the point of view of what I was doing professionally and what my interests were. So that was getting far more into things like meditation, philosophy, journaling, getting quite introspective, I think, which then led me to do a coaching designation a couple of years ago. But as you alluded to there in the newsletter, I'm here really just to try to make some sort of discovery around human thoughts or behavior, something unique. And, you know, my method for doing it at the moment has been interviewing people, chunks of people around certain questions that I find fascinating. So the newsletter, What is a Good Life, is that was based on 110 interviews I did with individuals for 45 minutes each. And with this, my life at the moment is very much just following what I'm interested in. It's led me to make some really strange decisions. Like I quit a job on the first day with a 40% pay increase and to do absolutely nothing that I didn't know at the time. And just trying to live a life a little bit more heart-led or intuition-led than just cold logic.
You want a more intentional life. And I think that's really interesting, because what you've mentioned in your introduction here is actually so amazing. You've got the travel, and you've come and you've literally left home, and you've just gone and just searched around for all of the things. What was it like traveling? What were you looking for?
So the first time I went traveling for 4 months, I'm 38 now and I was 31 at the time, and I went to India for 4 months. And to be perfectly honest, Alex, at that point, I just wanted the space to discover more about myself and potentially to fall apart even more. That year before I went to India, that was a really volatile year, I would say. Like I saw a psychologist for the first time. I started opening up to insecurities for the first time. And really realizing at the age of 31, despite projections of confidence, borderline arrogance, I was very unsure of myself. So the initial plan to go to India, I did some 10-day Vipassana silent meditation retreats, and meditation became very important to me. But it was just really that sense that I didn't want to have to go into a business meeting and someone asking me, how are you doing? And it's a client, and for me to go, well, you know, I'm feeling a bit sad today. You know, like it's usually you have to be a little bit upbeat and say, I'm wonderful. How are you? And yeah. I just didn't want to. I wanted space from playing any sort of game whatsoever.
Yeah, tell me more about the Vipassana meditation retreats. What was that like?
So the first time I did it was in India, and at that stage, I'd left London and I'd gone back home over the Christmas period. So while in London, I'd given up alcohol for 6 months. I'd given up dating for 6 months. I'd gone through a whole series of experiments trying to pick myself apart. Wow. I went back to Ireland that Christmas and indulged in every distraction possible. So by the time I got to India, I hadn't lived such a virtuous life, I'd say, in Dublin over Christmas. And then I arrived in this Vipassana center. After being kind of ripped off when I got to Delhi, I kind of arrived in Delhi with no plan, and I just thought I was going to trust the universe. May sound a bit cliched or naive, but that was my idea.
Yeah.
And so then I think the first few days of the Vipassana, to be honest, I was just thinking about vengeance on this chap who had overcharged me. So it wasn't too present an experience, but. You know, after the second night, I was, you know, the place that I was in was really basic. Like, I showed up and I said, am I the first Irish guy you've ever seen here? And they said, I think you're the first white guy we've ever seen here.
Wow.
So it was like well outside of the main cities, if you know what I mean. And so I was rooming with this guy, and I guess he must have been about 65 or so, this Indian guy. And even on the second night, he heard noises coming from my bed that he must have just thought that I was freezing, because you're not allowed to communicate with anyone. But he came over to put an extra blanket on me. But I was just almost having a panic attack, to be honest. Like, I was just left with my own thoughts for, even at that stage, 48 hours. And it was really, you know, I was really having earnest thoughts about the idea of jumping the fence. They have all your possessions, your identification and all that. I was thinking about leaving all that stuff behind and roaming the fields outside of the city of Lucknow in just like a, you know, a sheet draped over me. You know, and there's that crazy white guy in the countryside. You know, this was a thought that I gave to. But after that, it calmed down. And then, like, I broke through some of just the madness of the mind. Like, my mind stilled a lot more after that, those initial first 2 days. But mm-hmm. I'd say it's a very intense experience, because even when I've done it subsequently, like, the, not the monotony, but the isolation of no eye contact or no physical contact, that takes its toll as well, where you just kind of feel like you can be lacking that as well, even though you're probably sinking into something a little bit deeper within your own experience.
Yeah. If you want to explain a bit about what Vipassana is.
Yeah. So essentially, the first couple of days when you start it initially, you may just be focusing on the inhale and exhale directly from your nostrils. Like, wow. You're not supposed to be focusing on any other part of the body. As you evolve, though, you start doing body scans. So you're literally scanning down your body and feeling the sensations in each part of your body. And you're going up and down, and you're doing that repetitively. But the context for which it's set is, you know, there's no speaking, no eye contact, no reading or writing materials. You're up at 4:30 in the morning. You go to bed at around 9:30 at night. You've got about 3 hours, I believe, or maybe 4 hours in between 4:30 and 9:30 to just wander around the gardens or the premise yourself. But other than that, you've got scheduled times for meditation. So it's a pretty intense affair where, you know, you're really just left with yourself. And nothing kind of teaches me more about the base case madness of my mind than, you know, if I'm there on day six and I haven't had an interaction with anyone else, but I'm bringing up old arguments in my head, or past regrets are coming up that are haunting me, and you have nowhere to go. Like, you know, there's no phone to switch on and scan through whatever thing you may do to distract yourself. There's no nothing you can eat in between set eating times. And, you know, you've got no even form of exercise to do or anything like that. Like, all of that's not allowed. So you're literally just left with yourself. And it's a simultaneously really intense experience, but also liberating experience as well, because once you kind of get through it, or even just get through the points where you're struggling, like, there are many moments in it which are pretty, which can be pretty euphoric as well. Now, once you know that you can do without any distraction for 10 days, like, that's a very liberating thing to have in your back pocket as you go back into life. We can really reach for different things to distract ourselves from our own feelings, our own experience, our own discomforts. So from that perspective, it's quite a liberating experience.
Yeah. That process of being alone with your thoughts for a long period of time, I've looked at these retreats and they vary from 5 to 7 to 10 days working of their sort of the program is around that long. And I'm an extroverted thinker, so I like to talk through my ideas with people, or the things that happen to help me make sense of what I need to make sense of, because I will have moments where I am working through thoughts with people as I'm discussing the thoughts and coming to my own conclusion of what those thoughts are, obviously interested in what people contribute to them. And I think what frightens me or makes me anxious about that is that I will not be able to write it down or speak about it. So it stays with me.
Yeah.
in some particular way. How did you deal with that, and how did you reintegrate into the world after that? And how long were you doing it for? Sorry.
10 days. So I'd be quite similar to you. Like, I, in that sense, like, I have a notepad usually with me, either for the sake of journaling or jotting things down. And I really enjoy close relationships with people because it gives me a chance to play out these kind of thoughts instead of it just reverberating around in my brain and, you know, increasing the intensity of that thought if I'm not letting go of it. So I definitely find that a challenge. And even when you have moments where you think you've made some sort of breakthrough or epiphany or something like this, and you're like, I hope I don't forget this. You know, there's a real need. There's almost a real attachment to think I really want to write this down. Mm. But to be honest, it's just something that you get used to because the confines are the boundaries are in place. So it's more of a case, I think, of just adapting to what is and accepting that. Then is like my process is still to externalize and verbalize my thoughts with people because, like yourself, I like to bounce them off people. Just one, to get them out of just my own internal patterns, but also just for different perspectives on things. So it's not like it would have changed my approach in the long term, but in the short term, yeah, there's a real desire for that. But when you realize there's just nothing you can do about it, you can either prolong your suffering by staying attached to that, or you can just try to let go of it and move on.
Yeah. So reintegrating back into the world, though.
Yeah, like that for me is a little kind of anticlimactic, I would say, because you kind of think of this moment. I don't know if you've seen V for Vendetta, but the scene where Natalie Portman, she's been kept in the basement for a while, and then V takes her up to the top or the penthouse part of the apartment, and she's outside in the rain and the rain's touching her for the first time, and it's this euphoric moment. You're kind of very quickly, once your phone's put back in your hand, you plug it in, you see a few people that, I don't know, text you or didn't text you, you check the news, probably realized you missed nothing, and then life kind of goes on. Like, you know, the world didn't stop turning because you decided to unplug for 10 days. And it's, you know, like, while it definitely leaves a different perspective and it's really helpful to have those thoughts, I'm a big believer that it's not, you know, it's not just these moments that you have the big breakthrough or something like that. It's how you integrate it into your life thereafter. Like, you know, if I meditate for 30 minutes to 60 minutes a day, that's still only a very small percentage of my waking life, you know, so it's even with experiences I've had with psychedelics or something, like, these are big, they can seem like big moments, but the real challenge is the day-to-day stuff. Like, it's the reintegration of it and how you're showing up to your life in general, as opposed to, you know, as opposed to some big epiphany that's very intense, but then maybe not leads to a prolonged change.
Mm. Out of curiosity, what experience have you had with psychedelics?
I took part in a couple of ayahuasca ceremonies in a kind of a group setting. And then I've also I've tried San Pedro once again under the tutelage, I would say, of a psychotherapist, or they weren't not in their official capacity, but they were running some sessions with it. Then I've tried psilocybin mushrooms in large doses 3 times in a confined dark space with no music or distractions or just myself.
I'm interested in psilocybin. I don't know what San Pedro is.
It's like this cactus thing. So I think it could maybe that, like, an equivalent could be like peyote or something like this, but it's a lot more gentle than ayahuasca or psilocybin.
Okay. What was psilocybin like?
Yeah, really bizarre. Once a year I've said to myself, I'm going to do one experience. And I have done that for the last 6 years. And look, I don't recommend this to anybody. You know, this is just my approach. Like, I tried to consult people that I thought knew what they were talking about before, these kind of things. But this is a very personal thing. Like, when I hear people suggesting ayahuasca to somebody else, I think you're nuts if you don't know somebody's background. So when I did ayahuasca the first time, I'd seen a clinical psychologist for maybe 6 to 7 months that year. And I even asked her at the time, like, by the way, this opportunity's come up. What do you think? And there was no major pushback or hesitation on her behalf. One thing I'd say with all of these things is you'd really want to get a good handle on yourself and know that there's not something lying waiting for you in your subconscious that you haven't tried to, look, we're all works in progress, right? But that you haven't at least tried to engage with and struggle with before you try something else. That, you know, that's the only thing I'd say to people from based on my experience, because I feel I was somewhat ready to engage with ayahuasca the first time. But if I had done that without, let's say, the meditation before, the therapy or whatever, I think that would have been a real jolt or shock to the system. You know, because it just takes you into a, I don't want to say trite or something, but almost different dimensions of existence or a different, you're just operating on a different plane of existence or consciousness or something. Like, you know, I can't define it, but it's an intense experience. With psilocybin, though, specifically, that was the first time I did it. It was a curiosity to, one, scare the crap out of myself, and then two, to I'd research different things or different doses, and ask different people's opinions on something, and I wanted to have an experience of obliterating myself in a way, and like just my ego construct, and to have an elongated experience where I wasn't the center of the story. It didn't relate back to I. And so there was very intense experiences of like some sort of ego death, I'd say, involved, and then just kind of supernatural experiences in the sense of just different dimensions or different, you know, just very strange things to try to come back and talk to somebody about. Like just, yeah. You know, like even weird things like thinking I knew everything, but not in an egoic sense, but just that I felt that connected to the fabric of what is, that I was a part of it, therefore I knew it. So it definitely gave me things to consider in terms of just how connected everything could be, or how connected I could be with everyone else or everything else. So interesting experience.
Like in people and how it can help with mental health and general existential exploration for our own understanding of purpose and what that looks like for us. I'm not a huge fan of trends, but I have seen a lot of communication around these specific kind of plants lately. I guess it would take more research from me, but you know, it's interesting to hear what you said about your experiences with it.
Yes. Yeah, so look, I would be very skeptical as to lots of the trends and what people are saying. Like having been around some groups of people that have done these things, like with psilocybin, for example, I've done that in isolation, just with somebody around in case something went on, if something unpredictable went on. But I would say I'm very skeptical as to the trends. I see a lot of people that almost want to abdicate themselves of the responsibility for going to places in themselves or doing some self work or whatever it may be, and thinking that some of these plants can be, they're almost like a panacea for all your problems. And I really don't subscribe to that thought. Like for me, they give me glimpses potentially they give me different glimpses or perspectives on what reality could be. And that's something I'm fascinated in just my day-to-day stuff. Like I read lots into quantum physics and quantum mechanics, whatever you want to call it. And I'm very fascinated with the idea that as a creature, I probably have very limited capacities to perceive an objective reality. And so these are maybe just part of, once a year, these are kind of part of a process in which to see if I can glean anything else from a one-off experience. But as a continued thing or a process, I wouldn't be able to comment on that. I know John Hopkins are doing research on MDMA and I think psilocybin too, in terms of MDMA, in terms of PTSD and other things like that. So I do think there's a value to them, but I also think I'd be very careful if someone was coming to it and just asking someone who's very much in a scene as to just to how much they maybe glorify the effects of plant medicine.
And yeah, it's not a panacea for all of your problems, right? I think a lot of these things are and should be done in collaboration with this kind of support, yeah, to help you find the answers, because I think that's kind of what the purpose of, and it's actually so great that this is the segue that we've entered into. This is the purpose of what it means to have a good life in one strand, I suppose, one idea. But so you've got the project What Is a Good Life, and you spent time interviewing people around these big questions around what is a good life. What made you start this project? When did you start it? And what made you sit down and think, I want to collate all of these stories from people and get these ideas about this big question and put it into a newsletter form? What made you start that, to want to ask those questions?
Really, it was, these are the kind of questions that I've just become a little bit just perpetually fascinated with, and just questions that are really simple but really kind of complex at times to answer. And when I, like, so what I told you at the top of the interview, when I was offered this job 3 years ago with a 40% pay increase and I left on the first day, it was really just because the money side of things didn't seem so important to me anymore. And I thought there was a whole part of life that was unexamined, that I found much more fascinating to lean into. So with this, when I'd spent like a year in Peru that year, just really sitting with things like this and going through my own daily processes, I was just fascinated to try to bring some of this stuff back to, let's say, even an audience maybe that wouldn't have typically had this kind of line of inquiry. And so initially, I just wanted to ask people about what is a good life for them. You know, I mentioned to you already that I'd love to make some discovery. That's, for whatever reason, I just have this thing in my head that this is what I'm supposed to do. And it wasn't to figure out, this is like just a, this will be the first step in my process of interviewing lots of people, potentially around making sense of different people's thoughts. But it wasn't to prescribe the answer to what a good life is. What was annoying me with a lot of the self-development content I see, and even just, you know, you touched on it there with, let's say, Vipassana, or even if it was psychedelics, I see people get very entrenched in whatever it is their method is and prescribing that to other people. My idea with this was not to find a standardized approach to finding out what a good life is. It was just to show that people have many, many different perspectives on this. And really, the right answer is your own answer if you give yourself time to reflect. And if you're willing to spend time navigating whatever thoughts come up for you. So I started off without any plan whatsoever. I just interviewed 5 people on this without having a clue what it would become. And then I got really hooked on the idea, where I then posted it on LinkedIn, got lots of inquiries back to say that they'd love to do an interview. And then before I knew it, I was kind of 50 interviews deep in the space of a few weeks, and I just kind of kept going with it. And it wasn't until really I'd completed the 110 interviews that I had an idea then that I'd do a newsletter, because I'm not on any kind of real social media apart from LinkedIn. Posting stuff online is not really, you know, something that I'm accustomed to. So even the idea of making a newsletter or doing anything like this was completely foreign to me. But things just kind of fell into place. And then thankfully, people said nice things about it, or, you know, enjoyed being part of the process. And yeah, then you know, now it's potentially turning into an idea for a corporate wellness program. A couple of companies approached me about potentially building this into something where it could, I could repeat the same process in corporations. So bit by bit, just by kind of doing what I enjoyed or what fascinated me and following that curiosity, this kind of came to be.
It's a beautiful newsletter. What have you learned from these, from doing these letters?
Yeah, so I would say that it definitely reinforced my opinion that it's a personal answer for different people to come to. You know, if there's so much content that I think is out there that looks to focus maybe on what the average of a study is. But if my shoe size is 12 and somebody else is 6 and we both wear a 9, you know, that doesn't answer the question for us, if you know what I mean. It's definitely, because there's lots that I obviously don't include in these interviews, but it's definitely also helped me see that despite what someone's career and job title may be, because I found a lot of these people on LinkedIn when I posted it. So lots of people had, like, you know, very kind of senior careers and this kind of stuff. There's a big gap, I think, between the perception we have of somebody else's experience of life and what their reality is. I find that very interesting. I find it very interesting that we all experience this challenge. We all experience challenge in life. And also just, when I was asking people around the idea of like seminal moments of fulfillment in life, that it really broke down to the simple stuff, like the things that we define as simple, like, you know, going for a walk in the park with my kids, or gathering around at a social function with friends, or, you know, going for a bike ride on a sunny day, or being in nature. Like, considering I talked to a lot of people that had various different you know, things to share from their highlight reel of life, whatever you want to call it, people generally resort it back to just really simple, accessible things that are there all the time. But we have we have this mechanism within ourselves that we just seem to strive for things and ignore the things that we have, and kind of in a way create our own suffering in ways. So that was really interesting to me. Also the sense of, look, the two most frequently given answers were relationships by basically everyone mentioned some form of relationship, which, you know, will be coming up in future editions, but then also health. And given that the majority of people did have even physical health, I could say, and, you know, good relationships in their life, I don't know, it became very clear to me that, like, we kind of have the key ingredients for a good life, but it's almost in pursuing the cherry on top or the striving for that, that we can kind of ignore that we've already got, you know, if they were taken away from us, like health or good relationships, man, you do very well to feel like you're having a good life without those things. But we can kind of gloss over these things and take things for granted a lot. And I guess the final thing I'd say is, I think everyone has their own bit of internal wisdom. Like, you know, I specifically didn't want to interview a ton of everyone being an expert in a certain field of, you know, philosophy or psychology or whatever. Like, you know, there was obviously psychologists that I interviewed or different people, but they weren't branding themselves or positioning themselves as experts. And the experience that lots of people shared was that, you know, when I sent back the excerpt to them, they were like, did I say that? You know, there was almost like a surprise moment. Now, granted, a lot of editing goes into it, but I do make sure that the words that the interviewer use are the words that I use. I may just, like, if they said something interesting at minute 20 that connected with something they said at minute 38, you know, I'll move things around. But they are the individual's words. And I think there was always a kind of an aha moment in each interview where I was like, ah, that's I like how they put that together, or that made me think or stop in my own tracks.
I think that what would be good for us to do here is for me to throw back some of these questions that you have been asking people. So the first question I have to you is, what does the word freedom mean to you?
The first word that comes to mind when I hear freedom is choice, and that I can decide what I want to do with my day. And there's a degree of autonomy in deciding then how I'll, you know, potentially earn my living as well, that it won't be something that's kind of enforced upon me. And it's really I'd even just say a freedom to be myself. Like a lot of these things I find, like, to cultivate freedom in my life, it involves a lot of intentionality, you know, like really, in my case, I had to kind of deconstruct a past life in my mid-30s without knowing what I was going to do, and then wait for the, almost to have the patience then to wait to see what would appear in its place. And so freedom in that sense was definitely the freedom to go away from my immediate environment as well, because I think if I was living in Dublin or London or something like that, I would have really struggled to have stayed in those places while dropping things and, you know, going about my normal day to day, and people are saying, so you're doing what now? And trying to explain that all the time. So I think it was also the freedom to go to a different, go to just a different culture, a different way of life, and to just, yeah, to have the space. Space would be a big part of freedom as well. Just have the space to, like I mentioned in India, to fall apart, or the space in Peru not to rush myself into committing to something just because that would have been the expected thing to do.
What was it like entering your 30s?
30 for me, I've had this weird thing. 37 and 27 seemed like big ages for me for some reason. And then I have no idea why. And then 30 didn't seem much of a thing to me at the time. But when I turned 27, I thought, oh, damn, I'm not in my mid-20s really anymore. Like, you know, that was kind of the moment that I passed away, or passed that by. And then even when I turned 37, I felt far more reflective of like, oh, man, I'm not even mid-30s anymore. But yeah, entering my 30s then, like my first year of my 30s, or sorry, my second year, after I turned 31, there was a kind of an exponential learning curve in figuring out who the hell I was or what I was or what I wanted from life. So I would say an extremely volatile time initially, in trying to understand who I was, trying to deal with potential like old traumas from my childhood or something, which I just did not want to acknowledge or face growing up, which then led to, I don't know, which then just led to lots of unhelpful or unhealthy behaviors and relationships and stuff like that. So turning in my early 30s, that was a big shock to kind of go from the arrogance of my 20s, where I really pretended I knew a lot, or felt that I maybe even potentially felt that I knew a lot, to suddenly taking on a new or adopting a new mindset, which is, there's a lot that I don't know about myself, and having a kind of an insatiable curiosity or thirst for trying to figure out more.
Okay. And I always ask the age question out of self-interest, just because I'm turning 30.
I guess so, yeah.
I totally understood what you meant when you said you reached 27 and it's just like you're on this interesting slide to just a completely different decade now. You can't say you're in your early 20s, you can't say you're in your mid-20s, you're in your late 20s, and those late 20s are pretty much defined by the ages 27 to 30. And it's hugely reflective, because it's the first decade that you're a full adult, really. and you actually sit there, like, for the, and you know, you enter into that decade as a full adult. And I did want to ask then, are you satisfied with the level of freedom that you've experienced?
I'd almost think, like, freedom from myself as well, to be honest, or freedom from the parts of myself that I'd, or the life that I'd built up for myself, which was really inhibiting me from being myself. And I don't know if that necessarily comes with age or that comes with a deliberate attempt to shed some of that. But there was definitely, yeah, like I've, while I still don't, I'm 38 now, and whereas I don't know exactly where my, how my life is going or where it's going. Like there's enough paths in front of me now that I can kind of go, ah, now I'm back on a path where I kind of have some comfort again. But there was definitely a few years where I was like, have I made a absolutely stupid decision, or have I done the best thing that I possibly could have done for myself? And I don't know, I have this real belief that if we're just willing enough or brave enough to walk our own path, that incredible things can happen. It's not like a birthright, or it's not a guarantee. Like, you know, things can still not turn out all right, and you've lived your true self, or you've lived you've lived by whatever you've felt. But I do think that what I can definitely say about the last 6 years is that I've lived my own life, and I most certainly wasn't willing to do that. I would have been too self-conscious to do that in my 20s, and potentially too afraid to even go to certain places within myself in my 20s.
I wonder why that is.
Yeah, I think it's... I've always wondered, like, in the last 7 years or so, like, you know, when someone starts meditating or something like that, anything good that comes into their life, they typically start attributing it to meditation. It's a generalization, obviously, but it's just something I kind of noticed. Like, well, now I'm meditating, this has come into my life. But I also just wonder, which of those things that I would have maybe even given credit to meditation to, what would have just naturally have happened just by the passing of time? Like I really don't drink very often. And it's been a good while since I've even been drunk, I'd say, but you know, hangovers were also a nightmare in my early 30s. Like how much longer would I have kept it going? And I just wonder how much of this is how, you know, I can shape it by saying, well, I do these reflective things and therefore my life's changing. I do believe all these things do have a good impact on someone's life. But it would be interesting, like, just to see what would happen, as you kind of say, as you pass through time, what would naturally just evolve.
Yeah. I think I had a similar experience with alcohol. I went through a moment where I just stopped drinking this year.
Yeah.
For a long time, and I've only really started kind of drinking back again, but it's not to the quantity that I used to, and it's not, and it's very much about me maintaining control of that choice of when to drink, yeah, when I don't want to drink, you know. And I think that's very interesting. And I remember earlier at the beginning of our conversation, you said everything that is in your life, you've invited into it.
Yeah.
And I think that was a beautiful way of just articulating that you're able to take on the sort of experiences that are coming to you.
Do you know, I went back to Ireland recently, and I was just having a conversation with my brother, and we were driving somewhere, and I said, it's this kind of funny thing, like, if you decide to grow in life, you're going to suffer, right? Because not pointless suffering or something, but you're going to have to put yourself in new experiences. You're going to have to do things that maybe potentially frighten you. But at the same time, if you decide probably not to grow in life, and you just decide you really want to stay in your comfort zone, that will bring its own suffering. Like just in the vitality that you experience, or the enthusiasm you have, or the curiosity you have for life. So I don't, you know, like, I don't think that it's like you'll get to avoid suffering or discomfort in life. But I think there's far more enjoyment in life when you know that you've asked for these situations to materialize. And, you know, especially for me, shifting careers in my mid-30s, and just even right now at 38, not particularly feeling like an expert in anything that I'm putting. I'm trying multiple different projects at the moment, but not feeling like I'm an experienced expert in what I'm doing. Like, that's a really enlivening and vulnerable experience, you know. So it's both. Like, I think both, like, lots of experiences we have in life have almost this like bittersweetness to it. And when I feel like I've really decided that these were the things that I want to do, that's where you can kind of really get outside of that experience and not just go, oh, this is uncomfortable, therefore I'm going to maybe binge eat or binge watch something, or, you know, go on whatever device you may have or whatever anyone's distraction may be. Then it's like, ah, this is the point that I've got to now. And it's because good things are happening that I'm experiencing this discomfort. You know, like, if I'm going to be delivering corporate wellness programs in front of corporations or something, I don't have experience in that, but it's something that like speaks to me or excites me for what a potential effect I could have on the corporate world or something to this effect. You know, even putting out a newsletter on a weekly basis. Like, I know obviously you have far more experience in terms of putting work out there for public consumption. But putting that out for the first 9 or 10 weeks, like, that was every single time before I pressed publish, that was a vulnerable experience. And I'm getting more comfortable in that now, but I needed to go through that experience of discomfort before it felt anyways comfortable.
I think I've always looked at it, because I've never looked at it as like putting something out there for public consumption, although that's what it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've always looked at it as making a contribution.
Yeah.
To a conversation. And that is absolutely what you do. You're making a contribution to a conversation. And I think that once I began to shift my thinking around that, whenever you do something new and you feel like you're going to do something new, it's literally that. You're doing something new because you're making a contribution in a way that you may not see nor understand. Initially, you make a contribution to yourself when you try something new for yourself, and you make a contribution to a community, or quote unquote the world, when you put something out there on a regular basis. And I think that that's an important way that I don't think a lot of us are looking at it as. It's consume my content, consume my stuff, like, share, retweet, repost, all these
things. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And all of that stuff is amazing. Like, to get that stuff out there. But I think that we would benefit from a reframing. And that reframing is about the contribution, you know? And people are going to share they feel is adding value, right?
Yeah, and look, I fully agree with that. The idea of public consumption that I was more putting across was like, somebody else is going to get to see what I'm putting out. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And that for me, that was really challenging at the start, or even posting things on LinkedIn, because I had no experience with it, if you know what I mean. Like, I had no social media experience with any of this stuff before. So it just felt like a very new thing to me, even publicizing my views, I'd say.
Yeah. As the final few questions for this conversation, I like to ask... And the last question I always ask is, what does it mean to be human, in your opinion?
To be human for me is to experience as much of life as possible. It's to experience highs and lows, you know, it's to be wildly curious. It's also to be wildly neurotic at times. It's to love. It's to laugh. It's to fight. It's to cry. It's and it's utterly absurd. Like, do you know, like, whatever origin story you come back to, like, based on the confines which we live within in what we say is reality, you know, if you were to say the Big Bang or God, or go with Elon Musk and go a simulation or something like that, there's something like wonderfully absurd just about how the hell we're here or what the hell we're doing here. And I think, while I may never get an intellectual answer to that question, I think just the exploration of it is a hell of a ride.
For sure. For sure. Thank you so much for joining me, Mark, today.
Thank you very much for having me, Alex.
Do you have two books that you can recommend to listeners?
Yeah, the first book I would say is The Order of Time by Carlo Rovelli. He's an Italian physicist, but he writes with a real poetic flair and has a real interest in philosophy. So it's written for lay people like myself that have a curiosity for quantum physics. But it also just deconstructs the idea that time is this linear thing where there's a past, present, and future. And so for me, it blows my mind to just know once again that I'm a really blunt instrument in potentially acknowledging what an objective reality is. And that just opens up many other lines of thought or curiosities. So that's really interesting for me. Another book I really enjoyed would be, The Autobiography of a Yogi, which is, it's a long one and it's pretty out there. Like, it's by this guy, Pramanahasa Yogananda. And apparently it was the only book on Steve Jobs's, whatever the Apple equivalent is of a Kindle. And he gave it to everyone at his funeral. But it's really, just once again, it's just a bit like kind of deconstructed my own worldview and just made me a little bit more open to someone else's experience of life or reality. And it challenged me a lot in just even trying to go where the author had gone in his understanding of life and the cosmos and everything in between.
Yeah.